You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome back to Talk Back, the Dramatists Guild's conversation about the theater world we see and the one we want to see. I'm your host, Christine Toy Johnson. This season, we're connecting online from home as the world battles the COVID pandemic. Most theaters in the United States are currently closed. Our industry is hurting. But we're also exploring new ways to bring theater to audiences. We want to create a better and fairer industry than the one that had to close down due to the pandemic. And we can start with frank conversations about what has been working and what hasn't. Today we're looking at whether or not an MFA is worth the price of admission. They're a very popular starting point in today's industry, but they're not the only path to a career, and they're definitely not for everyone. I'm joined today by KJ Sanchez and Vichet Chum, who will introduce themselves.
Thanks, Christine. I'm KJ Sanchez. I bill myself as a writer, director, actor, and a producer. I'm the founder and CEO of American Records, a theater company that's dedicated to making work that chronicles our time, work that serves as a bridge between people. And I also am an associate professor at the University of Texas in Austin, and I run the directing program, and I'm the administrative head of both the MFA playwriting and directing programs. And I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you. Vichet.
I'm Vichet Chum. I'm a playwright and an actor. I went to the Brown Trinity Repertory MFA program, and I'm just thrilled to be here with you all.
So, Vichet, you just said that you went to the Brown program, but can you tell us what your MFA was in at Brown?
I got my MFA in acting. Something that is unique about the Brown Trinity program is that you also, while you're pursuing your acting degree, you're also taking directing and playwriting as well, because they really want you to get a well-rounded sense of what the other disciplines are doing. And so I really leaned into those parts of my education, and that has sort of led me into this playwriting career. It's an interesting moment to reflect on that time in my life, because I'm actually going to be on faculty next semester, which is kind of hilarious because I never would have pinned myself to be somebody who would step into that role. Trying to figure out what kind of space I want to create for students. And I'm just so curious what KJ has to say about all of that, because it's a really interesting moment. We're at the intersection of a pandemic and a racial crisis. And like, how do you educate students at this moment?
Before we get to KJ, I just want to follow up on something you said, Vichet, that you came to playwriting from learning that during your MFA in acting. What are you teaching when you are on faculty there coming up?
Oh, yes. I'll be teaching playwriting, which I did not get my MFA in.
Yeah, so really not full circle, but full circle.
Yeah, like full circle adjacent.
Yes.
You know?
It's awesome.
It's really strange because, you know, Christine, you and I have talked about this a lot, about how we don't have MFAs in writing.
Right.
And the sort of imposter syndrome we have as writers to a certain degree.
I have it as an actor, too, and I've been working my whole adult life as an actor. So, you know, go figure.
I mean, exactly. I mean, there's much to say about that. You know what I mean? There's much to say about, like, you know, the education on the streets versus, you know, the education in these sort of formal classrooms and at these institutions. When I was approached to teach this playwriting class, there was that part of me that sort of went, what do I know about anything? But I also know that because the pedagogy at Brown was such that led me to playwriting, there's something in that, you know? And I feel like I've written enough plays, I've seen enough theater, I've been around brilliant collaborators. Why not? Why not teach playwriting? So yeah, it'll be an interesting challenge for me.
That's great. KJ.
Yeah, I came to writing and directing later. I started as an actor and I got my MFA in acting at UC San Diego. And, you know, Vichet, I hear you about the struggles being in graduate school. I think graduate school is hard, and I don't think you're really in it unless you're really unhappy. And, you know, when I always have students who are coming into my office frustrated with themselves, frustrated with the notes that they're getting from their faculty, frustrated with the way the administration is relating to them, and frustrated with where they fit in the whole thing. I think graduate school is always a really difficult time in one's life. And if you're not angry at the school and your faculty, then maybe you're not quite deep into graduate school. And so anyway, I got out in 92 with an MFA in acting, and I had, because I broke my nose and learned viewpoints training in my third year of graduate school, I had the good fortune to audition for Anne Bogart in a production of The Women at San Diego Rep. And then she started the City Company. So I was an actor with the City Company for the first few years of the company's life. And then I realized I was a really bossy actor and meant to be a director. I was in the original production of Chuck Mee's Big Love, which started at Humana Festival and then went to BAM and Berkeley Rep and Long Wharf. And through the course of that, Les Waters was the director. And through the course of those 2 years together, I came out of the closet as a director. And so once I started directing, that led me naturally to being a playwright. You know, one, because my years with Anne and the City Company creating devised pieces, you think like a writer. And I started to have experiences in my personal life where I felt the need to throw myself into research and to build work as a way of managing trauma and pain and confusing times in my life. So I was a professional theater maker for about 25 years, and on and off, I was a guest artist at a lot of MFA programs in acting, in directing, and in writing at various colleges and universities. And then 4 years ago, I came to be a guest respondent at a New Works Festival here at UT, and I fell in love with this place. I sort of looked around and said, what is this magical land where the faculty are collegial and like each other and respect each other, even though there's so many different methodologies and systems happening. The students were so dynamic, and there was an opening for a faculty member. And Stephen Dietz said to me, are you interested in applying? And I said, hell yeah. And, you know, in a blink of an eye, Richard, my husband, and I moved to Austin, and I started running the directing program, and I teach playwriting classes as well. And, you know, back to that thing about who has the right to teach writing, and I think we all have this bias, this need for proving that we are masters of something. We all feel that weight. And even Stephen Dietz, you know, who's one of the most produced playwrights living today, he doesn't have an MFA at all. His mastery was experiential, and I sat in on his classes, and he teaches amazing writing classes. So I think it might not be about the paper that you earn, but rather where you come from and what have you learned about your own craft and your skill sets and your identity as an artist.
I want to talk to both of you about the impact of student loans and juxtaposed against the expectations of what the degree might get for a person. KJ, are you having conversations about expectations with your students now?
Yeah, we bring all of our finalists to UT to spend a few days on campus. They stay with current MFA graduate students, and we encourage them to ask all of the candid and hard questions. And then we talk to them about finances. And it's something that keeps me up at night, because I think it's unconscionable to encourage any artist to leave graduate school with huge debt. So we try to mitigate it. I try to mitigate those things as much as I and we can. At UT, we of course have the Michener Center for Writers. And so playwrights can apply for fellowships and to study with the Michener program. And that is a very well-funded fellowship. And so writers get paid to get their MFA in playwriting. And they also get a secondary in either fiction or screenwriting, writing for television. And then those who don't go through the Michener, we usually take two playwrights through theater and dance and through two through Michener, yet they all have the same faculty. We work with them as a cohort, and we don't see any difference between the two groups of writers. But the theater and dance playwrights, we get tuition remission and they're funded. And then we also look for teaching jobs for them while they're here. I've made my living as an artist. And for me, it's been about diversifying. And so that's one of the things that we work on here is giving our writers as many skill sets as they can. Recent graduates are now running Meow Wolf in Santa Fe, and they're opening up Meow Wolfs in Hawaii, and I think there's one in Vegas. They're writing for video game programs. They're writing for television. So we're doing as much as we can, but it definitely keeps me up at night, no doubt.
Vichet, do you have comments, thoughts, questions?
Yeah. KJ, you speak about, you know, making artists agile so that they can sort of meet the challenge of like being able to pay their bills and also honor their craft and what they do. And, you know, I just hope that more MFA programs are thinking in that way. Because, yeah, this is the stuff that haunts me, you know, the idea that like we financially value MFA educations at like over $100,000+. And, you know, there are socioeconomic implications there. You know, it's those who can afford it get the quote unquote best education. And I find that to be somewhat problematic and a little scary because, you know, as any artist who steps away from, you know, an MFA program and goes into the career of doing art, it looks different than the bubble of the being in an MFA program. It looks so different. I remember my first year out of graduate school, I was working at a hotel from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m.
Wow.
And then I would go on auditions in the morning or afternoon as I could get them. I would babysit some kids in the afternoon, and then I would go back to my shift, you know? And it was a pretty arduous experience and obviously not sustainable. And to be fully transparent, I got a full tuition to go to Brown. I still had student loans from undergrad and then also just trying to, you know, pay rent and to pay off my loans and to make sure I had food and whatnot. And I think that is the piece that I feel really conflicted about, because I think that I've seen my peers and my contemporaries just either step away from the arts because they just can't afford to do it. And I wonder about that. You know, I just wonder about what we're telling young-ish people as they move through their MFA education and then into the real world. And like, how much are we talking about professional development? How are we talking about the realities of stepping outside of that space, the MFA space? Those are all questions I have. And being a new teacher at an institution that is my alma mater, you know, I want to be really careful about, you know, what I relate to them about what it's actually like out there.
You're so right, Vichet. I too, like you, had a scholarship to go to get my MFA, but I also took out loans to help cover housing costs. And so, and then of course, like $100,000 is breathtaking, and if people are leaving grad school with that kind of debt. And, you know, housing costs for graduate students, Austin's really expensive to live in, and it's expensive even if you're just eating rice and beans every day. And then you get out, and like you said, those first few years are a struggle. So you have rising costs of living, and you have the cost of producing your own work, which is such a good way for young writers and directors and actors to get out there. And then coupled with, if you leave graduate school with conflicted feelings about racial biases, systematic right. racism, if your faculty didn't serve you, and I know, you know, we are human beings as faculty, and I've made mistakes. And I think when I lean into my fears about, I really need to make sure that these MFA candidates have all the skill sets they can. Like, I try so hard to build as much armor for them as possible. And I push really hard and I demand a lot. And I know that that's not great for everybody. And that's real and valid. So there's a lot to weigh. And when you consider that only those who are comfortable with the gross interrogation that's required in graduate school and comfortable financially, if those are the only people who can and are not, do not fall in the net of systemic racism and being the victim of systemic racism, then that means the pool that we're accepting is so narrow. And that's something that we all have to change just as an entire industry.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
How would you say that your experiences as two people of color going through MFA programs has influenced the way you address these issues, like you just mentioned, KJ, of systemic racism and dismantling it and going forward into hopefully creating the kinds of spaces where people can fully flourish and get all the benefits from not only the program, but from you as an inspirational teacher?
I find it challenging because in this moment, you know, I'm trying to hold two truths in my hand, which is I had a great time in grad school and I learned a lot. And also, like the spaces that need to be scrutinized and being a BIPOC artist at a white institution, yeah, there are moments when I felt really underserved. And it's so funny because, you know, a couple years ago, they asked me to come back and to speak with the students. And a young woman said to me point blank, as a person of color, did you feel supported at the school? And I said very succinctly, no. And I went into more detail about how, you know, I never had an AAPI identifying faculty member in my entire, you know, 7 years of arts education. And you think about how that is obviously disproportionate to my white colleagues. If you have a professor or someone in that space who shares some sort of identity with you, there's more at stake for both parties involved. I didn't have that sort of guidance. And I wasn't exposed to as much literature by AAPI writers. The only access I had to that was when we did the new play festival. And we luckily had Mia Chung, who was one of our MFA playwrights, and she was a student while I was there. And so I found it really challenging. I felt like I was sort of in a silo. But that also sort of lit a fire under my ass to sort of create those opportunities for myself. And that has been obviously the trajectory of my career.
Right.
I think most BIPOC artists would say the same, would have a similar version of that story of like, I felt alone. And so I had to create these opportunities for myself.
You don't see yourself in the stories that are being produced. So you create them so that you can.
Absolutely. I mean, that is the ethos of my writing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's, I know you and I have talked about this a lot too. It's like, we create jobs for our friends, right. You know, because it's, because I know what it's like to be an Asian actor in New York City. And I think there was one day where I had 4 TV commercial auditions, and it was Mongolian sheep herder, Chinese delivery man, valet, and then another delivery guy. And I was like, this is, and everyone has that story, yes. But it's like, this is what they perceive of me, right. You know? And like, we are so much more than that. Right. And so, I mean, that's something that I'm really trying to think about in terms of being the caretaker of a space in which I can encourage younger people to have that impulse that things are awful, and to translate that into something that perhaps is an opportunity for them.
Right.
Beautiful.
And those KJ. Instincts, I mean, the two of you have done such a great job writing characters and building work for all of your pals. And there are so many writers right now that I want to celebrate that are doing that. Like Christopher Diaz, when he wrote Chad Deity, and then it was done at every regional theater, and he gave so many BIPOC actors jobs. It's a double-edged sword though, isn't it? Because we start off writing roles and stories and people that we feel aren't on those stages. And then our community, our culture, our critics turn to us and say, like, well, that's what you should be writing, right? So I would guess, Bichette, you wouldn't want to only write stories about the Cambodian experience, the Cambodian-American experience. And yet there's this double-edged sword where we're trying to make room for our stories and our people, and yet we're also trying to keep that table big enough so that we can cook a lot of different meals. I just totally flipped my metaphors there.
I love that metaphor. I think it's great.
No, I think that's so, I think that tension is so right, KJ. You know, it's like, for me, I do have a mission to write as many Cambodian characters as possible. That is something that's sort of like at the center of what I'm doing. But also then, like, in the reality of Vichet Cham, in living in the United States of America and living in these spaces where I have friends who are not Asian American, you know, it's like trying to then sort of find the opportunities to sort of create a really expansive space in which, you know, it's not just Cambodian, it's also like, the questions that I deal with as a human being, as a Cambodian American, like how does the community, Cambodian community, deal with, you know, these questions of like racial justice and anti-blackness and like that is something I'm trying to fold more into my stories, because for me it's like, I don't live in just a silo of Cambodian-ness, you know, I live in a society with many different kinds of people, and I want to lean into those questions of how our communities intersect with one another, how they collide with one another, how people sit at the intersections of those communities as well.
Absolutely.
KJ, can I ask you KJ, are you having these kinds of conversations with your students now?
Oh, absolutely. Having the conversations with our students and having the conversations more particularly with the university's leadership. Tackling systemic racism within the academy is a major, major job. We've done so little in the last quarter of a decade. We've done so little in the last decade, really. It's a big, big mountain to climb. You know, UT is set in Texas, and there are Tejanos, there are Mexicanos, there are Mexican Americans, BIPOC people of all sorts, indigenous peoples, African Americans, Black writer artists, and yet the plays that we were producing when I first got here, and I'm not saying when I first got here as if I changed everything. That's not it at all. I think that the culture has been changing as I've witnessed it. But we were producing fewer people of color on our quote unquote main stage productions. The cohort of writers was less diverse than we would want it to be. And also the canon that we all refer to, you know, all of the books on writing and all of the plays that we study that come right from Aristotelian story structure, it's all centered in white experience. So it's so rooted, we were so rooted in Eurocentric methods and styles and traditions. So we're trying to tackle that. And then, of course, the big thing, which is access. One, can you afford to come to school? We 2 years ago, we had the opportunity, Stephen Dietz switched to teaching less and writing more. And we had an opportunity to do a couple of other hires for our faculty. Right. What was really great is when we were talking to when Kirk Lynn, my colleague who runs the playwriting program, you know, was talking to the leadership of UT, and they wanted these writers with these accolades and critical acclaim. And Kirk was great at making it clear, like, if it's not just about getting great writers who will bring a whole new set of diversity in terms of form, philosophy, race, culture, content to our program. If you want this, and if you're serious about this, you have to bump up the fellowships that playwrights are getting. And so that was like one of these great storms, one of these pivotal moments where leadership stepped in and did that. So it's access, and it's, and then the big step is making sure that everybody feels welcome, you know, right. And the little things that were, that I see my colleagues paying attention to, even down to security, you know, there are security guards that go through our building and we note who they stop and ask, should you be in the building? You know, because everybody's leaving rehearsals at 11 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. You know, some people are staying in to work even later than that. And we're noticing who gets stopped and is asked, should you belong here? It's like the smallest gesture to the largest gestures. We need to do what we can to make sure everyone feels welcome, because you can't be the best writer you are unless you feel welcomed to the party, right?
Yes. Yes, of course.
Right. I think it's great. I'm also not an administrator, so I don't know how all of those details work out.
Right.
But I think it can only expand the applicant pool, and it can only sort of give prospective students, you know, that sort of welcome that KJ is talking about. Like, we don't want to burden you with this, you know, this mark of X amount of dollars. We believe in your artistry, your budding artistry, and we want to cultivate that. And I think that there are so many variables that keep that sort of identify students in different ways, you know, whether it's race or gender or sexuality or whatnot. To be able to say to students, like, we're going to start your education fully subsidized so that you can, to a certain degree, something that we can control, which is from a level playing field of just being able to, like, be here. And yes, there are other variables at play, of course, but just like the idea of an institution saying that to a group of young people, saying, you know, we're going to pay you to be here. I think it's really powerful, and I hope that that's something we're moving towards.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about the administrative stuff, so KJ can speak to that.
I think that, so what I've read of Brown, tuition is covered. What was called a free ride. I'm not sure how I feel about that phrase, free ride. But tuition's covered at Brown, at Yale, I believe, at UCSD. I think UCSD has a really robust funding package for MFA writers. UT covers tuition, as far as I can tell, you know, with loans taken out for cost of living. Our recent graduates are leaving with approximately $20,000 in debt. Those that are leaving with $100,000, like, that's huge. And I remember I was talking to a prospective applicant a couple of years ago who wanted some advice about which programs she should be applying to and how much it'll end up costing her. And she was thinking about some of the programs where you will leave with over $100,000 in debt. And I said to her, I said, like, well, instead of spending that money getting your degree, if you took $100,000 and used that to produce your own work, that is a totally viable avenue. And then she said something that made me realize just like what a jerk and how short-sighted I am. Because she said, well, here's the thing. When you are accepted into a MFA program, into a university, you can apply for loans. If I'm an individual who just wants to produce my plays out in the world, I can't find a loan to give me $100,000 to produce my plays. So again, if you're thinking about the choice, should I spend the money in just getting my work out into the world, or should I spend my money in graduate school? It's still a game for trust fund recipients.
As we're wrapping up, I wanted to ask you both if you have any advice you want to give to any theater artists who are considering making this financial and emotional investment in an MFA. Vitette?
I would say, you know, watch closely at how the programs that you're interested in are dealing with this specific moment. You know, how are they handling teaching during a pandemic? You know, how are they working to create more inclusive spaces and commit to anti-racist practices? I think that's a big question right now with all the MFA programs. And then also in terms of the access question, definitely prioritize programs that will pay you to go there. And then also like know your financial situation. And then also just know what you want from the experience of going to grad school. I think that if you believe solely that it'll be a direct pipeline to success and to fame, I think you'll end up being disappointed ultimately. I think that that's not what an MFA is actually about.
That's great advice.
Such great advice. Wow. To add to that, I would say that I think graduate school isn't for everybody, and there's power in that. You know, one of my favorite directors, and I think one of the finest directors working today, Pam MacKinnon, didn't go to an MFA program, but instead, you know, she came to New York and she started working with Club de Thumb and doing lots of readings and just reaching out and contacting writers and starting collaborations. And her work is extraordinary. So graduate school is there. There's also a right time for it. And I think applicants should know that they're actually the ones with the power. And I think I would advise to approach graduate schools as you would, getting into a very long-term and intimate relationship with somebody. It's like a marriage, you know, and you get a chance to choose who you're going to be married to. I would advise approaching it as, are we the right fit together? Because so much of it is about chemistry. It's also about, are you ready to interrogate your work? There are times in my career where I wasn't ready to analyze what I'm doing. I needed to do and not hear a lot of feedback about what I was doing. And then there are other times when you really need to examine your craft goals. And I think that's what graduate school does. Three things I think graduate school does best is really helps you interrogate who you are and what you want to say. I mean, anyone who sat in on a casting call from the other side of the table, if you're not the person auditioning, but you're watching the audition, you see that casting isn't necessarily about the best audition. It's about a director and an actor figuring out what's our chemistry? Are we going to work well together? And are we going to make something that's bigger than the sum of all our parts?
I can testify that anyone who gets to work with either one of you is really, really fortunate. And I think that your students are also just the luckiest people. My thanks to today's guests, Vitette Chum and KJ Sanchez. If you're considering an MFA, please do check out Brown and UT Austin. Next week, we'll be discussing meaningful inclusion of people with disabilities in the theater. My guests will be Greg Mosgala and Katie Sullivan. Talk Back is a production of the Dramatists Guild of America. It was produced by Sarah Storm, Amy Von Masick, and myself. Our music was composed by Andrea Daly.
Robert Prine mixed our show. Special thanks to Tina Fallon, Terry Stratton, and the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee at the Dramatists Guild. I'm your host, Christine Toy Johnson. Please support your favorite theater however you can. We'll be back next week.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.